Thanks, Fiona. It was bringing us that that story. I did want this morning to bring a case of good red wine. I'm a bit of a wine slob myself, so I wouldn't know what a case of good red wine really looks like. I realise that this is kind of a subject area too when we start talking about wine. For some people, there are all kinds of threads in our stories, and some of those threads are not so good threads because we maybe been brought up in a home where there's been an alcoholic, and talking about drinking wine and enjoying it, it's not a positive association for those who, of you who have those threads in your story. Or maybe you've had other experiences related to intoxication or abuse of alcohol that have created scars and trauma for you. So I just want to be respectful of that and acknowledge that that's in the room for us this morning while talking about this. But I also want to kind of embrace something of the invitation and the lightness and the celebration of this story. And so coming back to this thought that I had that maybe I could get a, and I even had to, I didn't know what a good wine looked like. So apparently the Atarangi Pinot Noir from Martinborough is on the list, on many people's list, as a top wine currently. But at $69 a bottle, I wasn't going to be getting a box of that to bring along or more. You know, we could provide fruit juice, but the problem that we really ran into was that the rules of hire for the hall mean that we can't consume alcohol on the premises. There is one infamous incident, at least, where that was breached, and many of you were present for that and participants in it. Shame on you. Apparently Matt on one occasion here, brought along a few of his tools, and Matt Barnes, I'm speaking about here. Matt, are you here this morning? No, he's not. Okay. Anyway, he demonstrated some of his home brewing skills. How many of you were present for that and participated? We're going to write down some names here so we can get a report to the school. It was a memorable occasion in the life of this church. Legendary, perhaps. It might have reached legendary status. I know that I've had innumerable people in casual conversation bring this story up with me. And what a wonderful moment it was of celebration in the church's life. I couldn't really bring myself to break the rules today. I was feeling far too responsible and a little wary of the consequences. So no case of great red wine or supplementary fruit juice for those who wanted to have that option today. And we all understand why the school has rules like that and other bodies too. Wild parties in the hall, loud noise, property damage, public disorder, arguments, fights, neighbour complaints, broken glass in the grounds, vomit in the gardens. I'm not talking about what would happen after church services here. But, you know, if that kind of thing was allowed in the school, it would definitely be problematic. So, but I have been thinking about how rules written and unwritten can stand in the way of connection and celebration. Whether they're rules that we have in our heads that we've become governed by, maybe neurotic little rules that have woven their way into our subconscious that keep us from celebrating life, or other rules that society imposes upon us, or maybe even church communities have. And in this passage this morning, we find Jesus breaking the religious rules and the social expectations in order to free up the flow of life among the guests at a wedding. So what I'd like us to do is to fill our glasses this morning, which we will do later in communion, with a generous portion today, in keeping with the story, and drink in some of the good wine of the passage. And when you come to the story, it's sometimes good just to go right to the concluding part where John sums up his intention for including the memory of this incident or the story about this experience in the life of Jesus and his followers. It says in verse 11, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So that verse, if you like, is the lens through which we might have a little look at the story. John says what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs. So when you look at what Jesus did, and there are several other characters in the story as well, which we can come to, the thing that everyone notes and remembers is that what Jesus did is he turned water into wine. John highlights this later on in chapter 4, verse 46, when memorializing the story, he says, once more Jesus visited Cana in Galilee where he had turned water into wine. So within the storyline of John, the reason for incorporating the story is because of this act which was memorable in the minds of all who were present and all who heard about it. By the way, I can't help listening to that phrase, he turned water into wine, without remembering a song of Johnny Cash. Any of you remember that one? He turned the water into wine. It's kind of, you know, it's like one of those things runs through your head. But Johnny Cash, if new, is his life story is one of, you know, experiencing water turning into wine, the tragedy and the struggle and the trauma of his own life, including struggles with alcoholism, trying to find its way into a changed life. But there's a lot more going on in this story than simply the recollection that there is this event that occurs where water is turned into wine. And if you have trouble scientifically accepting that that could be possible, that's fine this morning. Stick with the symbolism of the story, because the story is there as a sign of something much, much more important. So don't get kind of stuck on, you know, where a lot of people get stuck on, is this really possible? Kind of for me, I think that if, you know, Jesus could turn death backwards, then messing with the molecules in water and shaping wine ain't much of a problem. But you know, that's not the point of the story. So what is going on? Jesus goes to the wedding along with his mum and his disciples. Let's not miss that. It's a little country wedding, an everyday couple celebrating everyday love. It's not a celebrity event or a power couple event. Maybe just a relative or a friend. But he's there and he's supporting and he's affirming, and he's celebrating. Alongside the families, the bride, the groom, the guests, Jesus is baptizing the ordinary. Jesus is baptizing the routine. Jesus is baptizing the commonplace events of everyday life by being present and attentive to those who are there and what's going on. And I find comfort in that. This is just an everyday country wedding, and here is Jesus present at it alongside those who are there. And he has a conversation with his mum. This is something else that takes place. She draws his attention to a brewing problem. They've run out of wine. Stop your whining. It sounds like something you say to the kids in the back of the car, doesn't it? But they've run out of wine, and she wants him to do something. She knows her son well, and she wants him to step in and to solve the problem. I mean, it's definitely a catering fail, isn't it, if you have an open bar and the bar runs dry, or if the food that's been provided is insufficient for the guests that are present. So we could understand how the bride and the groom and the families responsible for the wedding would have felt embarrassment and maybe a little bit of shame. It does feel a little bit like a first world problem, though. There's no huge tragedy here, really, just some social embarrassment. There's no heartbreaking distress. And Jesus does seem reluctant to get involved. He seems, the way John writes the story, to feel that if he acts now in a particular way, it won't be in accord with his understanding of the Father's purpose for his life. He talks about my hour not being, my hour hasn't come yet. And he seems to have this reluctance to act in case he's being driven by his own ego or driven to please the crowd or even appease a family member. There's a strange reluctance going on here from Jesus to get involved. He and his mum don't appear to be on the same page. That can happen a lot around weddings. A bit of family tension to navigate and negotiate here. And his response to his mum in verse 4 sounds rude and harsh, abrupt, patriarchal, misogynistic perhaps, from our cultural perspective. But is he really being hostile and rude? Some people will take a different angle on this, but I think that what's going on here is if we read through our cultural lens and impose that onto Jesus, then we miss the bigger picture of how he is in the Gospels with women and with others and the respect that he shows them and the dignity that he treats them with. So his use of the word here is unusual because he's talking to his mother. But rather than seeing it as a sign of rudeness or hostility, we can see it as a sign of this hesitation that he has. The phrase, "What concern is that to you and me?" has been pointed out as a common Jewish expression that implies a sense of disengagement, not hostility. It's like standing back, downplaying the relationship so there can be a bit of distance here. Well, he reconfigures in his own mind and heart what he's going to do. Needless to say, there's still something going on in the family here and in the relationships that's difficult to navigate. And they're trying to find their way with it. Jesus' distancing is coming about because he's saying, the ultimate steps that I will take are not going to be now. The hour that he's referring to as it's used in this gospel is a reference especially to Jesus' passion and death and resurrection and those particular events. And Jesus has the sense that this is where his life is heading, even at this point in his journey. So Jesus has this conversation and reluctantly, it would seem, steps in to act. And he does so by working behind the scenes, not by throwing himself into people's view and drawing attention to himself, but working behind the scenes, giving a few instructions to some other people who are often unseen, the invisible people at a wedding, you know, the ones who are doing all the money to make it happen, the magic happen. The low-paid workers, usually in our world, who have been employed on casual, contracts with low hourly rates to often do this work that goes on at weddings and often on the receiving end of not much appreciation from guests at times. But these are servants in a household, it would seem, or households. And Jesus invites them to be a part of what he's going to do. He tells them to fill the jars and then to draw some water and take it to the master of the banquet. So there's no big dramatic gesture. And there's just a quiet working behind the scenes involving people who would otherwise be forgotten, inviting them to be the participants in an act of extravagant generosity. People beavering away in the background become the channels through which the generosity of Jesus and the goodness of God finds expression and flows into the world. Isn't that beautiful? Because I still think that that's what God is about. We're looking for the dramatic. We're looking for the extreme. And God is saying, I just want ordinary people available to respond to my invitation to be a part of spreading this beauty and goodness and generosity in the world. And these are people who don't fully understand. They're talking to each other going, what the heck is going on? You know, he's asking us to fill these jars with water. What? We don't understand. Does he know what he's doing? They don't understand. Some of them doubt. The people who may be a little reluctant, people who are tired and just want to go home, people who are over it, the forgotten, the unnoticed, the underappreciated. But they get on and they just do it. They do what Jesus asks and they become pipelines for the grace of God. And the water they fetch and pour into the jars turns into the best ever wine. The master of the banquet doesn't know what to do with it. He tastes the wine and he's kind of going, not quite sure what that flavor is in there. After all, it has come from these jars that are used for ceremonial washing, remember? You know, a little bit of wheat grain and goat dung in there or something. That, who knows? Who knows? Did the flavors come off the insides of the jar? But here is this just group of people who are participants with Jesus in bringing God's goodness into the world is the way John is shaping the story for us. And then Jesus, it tells us in terms of actions, he just heads off to another village. Mum and his brothers and the disciples, they're off. He's not hanging around to soak up the accolades. Look at me, look at me, look at me. he's just moving on. When John writes about the story, he says it's a sign which reveals the glory of Jesus. And the first of a number in this gospel, some scholars describe the first chapters in John as the book of signs. There's seven in particular that are named and explored by John. And when John comes to the end of his gospel, he says Jesus did many other signs. He doesn't call them miracles or some other name. He just calls them signs. These are symbols pointing beyond themselves. We saw lots of those in India. Signs on the side of the road pointing beyond themselves. One of them I noted read, "I am curvaceous, be slow." I am curvaceous, be slow. Now, that sign is quite ambiguous. But in the context of driving the roads in India, there are lots of them trying to kind of encourage drivers to be careful on the roads. When I looked at it first, I thought it might have been advice from a sex therapist, but I wasn't quite sure. I'm curvaceous, be slow. But then I realized it wasn't. It was something else. They are symbols that direct our attention elsewhere. Symbols, signs, pointing beyond themselves, not ends in themselves. And in John, they point to the identity of Jesus as the Son of God, the revealer of God, the Word made flesh, and they also point to his mission. This language that is used, which is like a little hint carried in the story, where John sets us up by saying, I'll just turn back to the text. On the third day, a wedding took place. The third day. The third day. And it's like this little hint, because the third day is a reminder of later in the story where it says that Jesus rose on the third day. And again, in John's story, he's using this to point towards the fact that Jesus is going to do something which is symbolic of his grand purpose, which will also be captured in the end events of his life when death cannot hold him down. And he's able to break free from the grip of death, holding the promise of a life that is much more powerful than what death seems to convey. Now I've lost my page. So, just thinking about this, these signs, this Jesus is saying is a sign. It points beyond just some ability, beyond the ordinary, to a purpose that is bigger for Christ and for humanity, bringing in the new wine of God's life to the world so that people, ordinary people, can access that and move into the flow and experience of that life themselves. And John tells us that his disciples believed in him. They trusted in him. The actions of Christ in the world, through others as well, are designed to help us, point us towards the life of God present in the world and bring us into a life-giving relationship of trust ourselves. A relationship that will take the water of our lives and turn it into wine. A life where we exchange the rituals of religious purification for a relationship of transformation. And that is held present to us too in the use of these jars. And the fact that they're used for washing, trying to make myself clean for connection with others, trying to make myself clean for connection with God, trying to make myself clean so that I can connect even with my inner self. And it's like Jesus is saying, no, it's not about that. This is glorious celebration of life being, an affirmation of life being offered in Jesus that we're invited into. Faith's a bit problematic to us often in our world, isn't it? Greg Boyd describes this faith that is portrayed in John as, he calls it covenantal faithfulness, and says it's not about feeling certain, but about a willingness to commit to living for God in the face of uncertainty. Like the servants filling the jars, like Mary asking Jesus to act and leaving him to decide what he's going to do. Like Mary saying to the servants, do what he told you to do. I don't know what he's up to here, but just do what he tells you to do. And Bond says, our boy rather says, faith is different from belief. He says, belief is like an opinion about something or someone. Well, faith is a willingness to commit to a course of action on the basis of the opinion. Interesting, isn't it, that this happens in the place of a wedding where lives come together to forge commitment, to forge union, to demonstrate trust in one another. And, you know, before I married Jill, I had to first believe a number of things about her. But I only became married to her when I demonstrated enough trust to commit to living the rest of my life as her partner and her husband. You know, opinions and beliefs had to be turned into a demonstrable commitment. And now I do what she tells me, as you can all clearly see. So, you know. Do what she tells you. Isn't that what it is? Oh, sorry. Do what he tells you. Oh, we'll have to go and revisit that after the service, won't we? But here is the distinction, you see. This is an invitation into a trusting relationship. Do we take the risk of trusting Jesus and the life that is being offered in Jesus and following in that way and take up a part alongside Christ in the world in which we live? Jesus didn't do this by himself. Mary declared the need, the emptiness. They've got no wine. The servants poured the water. The chief steward tasted, recognized, and named the good wine. We all have our parts to play too. Let me finish with a story, and let me just put a little warning here. There's a part of the story which speaks about somebody's experience of abuse. So I just want to let you know that before I tell the story, because it does contain an aspect of somebody's trauma. But there's a redemptive thread to it as well. So I was introduced to a friend this week who has worked in pastoral ministry for quite some time. And they had a young woman who came to be a part of their church family. He spent time journeying and getting to know people and connecting, and started to have this interest in becoming a follower of the way of Jesus herself. She approached the minister in the church and said, I really want to get baptized. And the pastor said, well, we'd love to do that. You know, let's talk about it and let's set it up. And she said, I'd like to be baptized in, I don't want to be baptized in church, I want to be baptized in water. And I want to be baptized in the sea. And so he dug down and explored, you know, why is it that you want to be baptized in the sea, particularly, not a river, but the sea. And she said, well, I had a tragic experience earlier in my life, and I was raped on a beach. And I feel that this experience in this way can be part of a redemptive story for me. so they talked about where this could take place, and they decided it would be Shag Rock, the rock that has fallen apart. Sitting down on the road, I think most of us in the room know where that is on the road to Sumner. And there are little pools that form often behind that rock at low tide. It's changed a bit now, so I'm not quite sure. I'm not as familiar with that. But another part of her story that was going on at this time is she found out, while this was going on, that she was whakapapa Māori, kaitahu. She never knew about this thread in her story. She found it out during these years. And so they went to Shag Rock, and at the time the clouds were over the sky. It was one of those Christchurch days, you know, where it's just blah and blur. But when they got down to the rock, the clouds peeled back and a shaft of light shone right down into their spot. And so they conducted this baptism. And she carried on her journey in the life of this church. And pastor of the church said, shortly afterwards, he was talking with a kaumātua, a local kaumātua. And he talked about this and he said, do you know that that place by that rock is where there were ritual, traditional cleansings that Māori had as part of their tikanga? That place is a sacred place. It's a thin place. It's a place where Māori knew that their own wairua could be nourished in different ways through some of these practices that they had adopted. And he said, I never knew that. And he said, doesn't matter, bro. You listened inside and you heard the voice of the one who loves all directing you to that place together. And so the next steps on her journey began of discovering who she was in Christ and who she was as Māori. The new wine of Christ, when it flows into our lives, weaves into those deep places of hurt and pain and trauma as well to help us find a way into places of wholeness and healing. Also carries us forward, working together with Jesus to spread that goodness into his world. Generous bread and juice this morning, Helen. How would you like to come and lead us as we share communion together?